Sitting on the front porch, ice cream in my hand, melting in the sun, all that chocolate on my tongue, and that's good enough reason to live.
Yes, chocolate is a good enough reason to live. Who doesn't love chocolate? So do you like dark chocolate or milk chocolate or white chocolate? Can you describe what chocolate tastes like? Do you know why you like one of the chocolates more than another? We are going to learn more about flavor this hour and how we can distinguish and describe different flavors and why some of us love certain flavors and others not so much. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We are going to talk with the author of the book Flavor, The Science of Our Most Neglected Sense. And we'll welcome your questions and we'll welcome your own observations. How is your sense of flavor? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Bob Holmes is a longtime correspondent for New Scientist magazine and describes himself as a passionate home cook. His new book is Flavor, The Science of Our Most Neglected Sense. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for being with us. So these days we do live in a food dominated culture. Food is all over TV. Chefs are constantly chasing new and exciting trends. We all love trying new restaurants when they open up in our town. Yet you say flavor, which is at the root of all of this, is our most neglected sense. How can that be?
Well, for one thing, it's had much less attention from researchers. People know a lot about how the senses of sight and hearing work, but we still don't actually know how odor receptors detect the molecules that they do. We still don't know how different receptors' inputs come together to make a general perception of smell. We still don't know how flavor gets processed in the brain entirely. It really does lag behind. And that's true in the general public, too.
Yeah.
We all talk about tasting food. But in fact, if you pinch your nose and eat a jelly bean, you won't have any idea what flavor that jelly bean is. All you'll taste is a little bit of sweetness. That's what taste is. And when you let go of the nose, then all of a sudden you'll be able to tell, oh, yes, this is a cherry jelly bean, or, oh, this is lime or banana. In fact, when we say we're tasting a jelly bean, we're actually mostly smelling it.
Yeah, that's interesting. And maybe just talk a little bit about that, the science between smell and taste.
Well, I guess that's the main thing, is that the taste does the real basics. It's sweet, sour, salty, bitter, umami, and actually probably a couple of others as well. But all the detail is filled in by the sense of smell.
Yeah, so if we have a poor sense of smell, we're really not getting the full flavor of things.
Right. So, you know, everybody has that experience when they have a cold and their nose is plugged up. And we say, oh, I can't taste my food because I have a cold.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, you've got that exactly wrong, because all you have is taste. You can't smell your food, and it has much less flavor.
It's so funny, because right now, I just on a whim brought in a bunch of different types of foods because I wanted to do taste testing on the air.
Uh-huh.
And I can smell the strawberries that I put in front of me. It's a really strong smell of strawberries,
mm-hmm.
and it's a luscious smell, and I can taste them, even
mm-hmm.
though I'm not eating them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also funny that I put them on a white plate, even though it's not quite the same example you used in your book. Our eyes and what we see also affect how the flavor of things to us.
Totally. Expectation and memory play a big role, which is why you can taste those strawberries even though they're not in your mouth, because you know you've got the smell, you've got the sight of the berries, and they stand out against the white plate. Yeah. So definitely expectation plays a huge role in modifying what we're experiencing.
Yeah, and I don't know, you don't have to recite the whole experiment, but apparently just putting a strawberry on I don't know, a brown plate, it's not going to be as appealing as this, as if I put it on a white plate. A strawberry mousse on a white plate will taste better than on a different type of plate.
Than on a black plate, yeah. And that's one of the classic experiments, that people will find that this strawberry dessert tastes sweeter from a white plate than it does from a black plate. And almost certainly that's just because the white plate shows off the red color better. And therefore you get that visual expectation, that visual reinforcement.
Yeah, and you touched on it, but I just want to kind of get back to the difference between flavor and taste. And we do tend to use those two words interchangeably. Like I'm fighting it right now. What do they really mean, the same thing, or are they truly different?
Well, in the strict sense. Taste is what happens with the taste buds on your tongue. That's sweet, salty, sour, bitter, umami, and these couple of others. But the English language lets us down here because we don't have a word for the whole perception of flavor. And so we default on taste. I mean, you go to a wine tasting, even though you don't just say, oh, yes, this is bitter. Oh, I get a little bit of sour here. You say the dinner tastes good, even though you don't mean that, well, the salt was correct. So it gets a little bit confusing sometimes in the vocabulary because we lack that word, and so do almost every other language.
Yeah, and that's true. And I'm thinking of, I'm not a very good cook. You are, but I have taken...
I'm enthusiastic, not necessarily good.
I've taken some cooking classes, and we always talk about layering flavors, like when making a soup. So, I mean, that's because the garlic will give it something, and the onion will give it something, and then, that olive oil will do something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, chefs talk in terms of bottom notes, middle notes, and top notes, where the top notes are the immediate hit of flavor that you get, and then as that fades, you get some middle notes, and then you get to the lingering bottom notes, like vanilla, that stay with you for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So, definitely chefs think in terms of layering things, but so do professional flavorists when they're designing something like a strawberry flavor.
So, why is it, why do you think it's important for us to have a better understanding and appreciation of flavor?
It makes life more fun, I think. Eating is something that we do, most of us, at least three times a day. Why not get more pleasure out of it? Knowing what's happening makes you stop and think about it.
Yeah,
and enjoy it a little more.
When you were just mentioning tasting, like wine tasting, I was doing wine tasting in when I was on a vacation over the weekend in Door County, where they have a lot of wineries, and that one's too bitter, I don't like that, or that one's too sweet, but I can't talk about the rich undertones and oak flavors and the hint of fruity whatevers. Why can you do that or someone else do that and I can't?
I can't do it very well, but in fact it's mostly a matter of practice. If I give you two different glasses of wine and you can tell that they are different, then you are perceiving everything you need to do to be able to tell things. And all that's lacking is connecting the vocabulary. That's what wine professionals have that the rest of us don't, is that amount of practice and memory. There have been a few studies that test whether wine professionals have a better noses than the rest of us, whether they can detect things at lower quantities, and they don't. They have noses are just like yours and mine. What's different is that they can put the words to it. They can recognize how to describe the odor that they've got, and that's purely a matter of practice.
Yeah. So you mentioned in the book that we can get better at appreciating flavor.
Sure.
Tell us how we can do that.
Just by doing it, by trying to put the words to it. To take wine for an example, if you know, you can find online wine flavor wheels or lists of possible flavors that you can find in wine. And next time you drink a glass of wine, have one of those lists next to you, and it's much easier to pick out the right term from a list than it is to fish it out of the air. So, you know, when you have your glass of wine, run down the list and see what is that flavor. And that helps me a lot. I actually picked out star fruit in a wine the other night, which I would never have done on my own, but it helped to have it in the list. And just doing it over and over again makes all the difference, because gradually you start to be able to come up with those terms right out of thin air. But, you know, any of the wine professionals that you talk to have put in hours and hours of practice doing that. Some of the academic wine people train by buying, you know, sort of nondescript wines and then crushing a little bit of raspberry in one and a little bit of blackberry in another and a little bit of strawberry in another and comparing them to be able to pick out, okay, so this is what I mean when I say strawberry, this is what I mean when I say raspberry. And just doing that over and over. I mean, most of us aren't going to be obsessive enough to do that for, you know, thousands of hours the way a wine professional would have to. But
yeah, and
who
you,
cares?
I found in the book there was an example where, and I wanted you to kind of just walk us through this very simple exercise, if you recall it, using an apple, how we can better understand and appreciate and form those words so we can describe what we're tasting. Do you remember that eating an apple exercise?
Yeah, a little bit. So it's a matter of being systematic, rather than just taking a bite of the apple and saying, huh, that's a good apple. Try and articulate it a little bit more. Does it have a lot of acidity? Is it a very tart apple? Is it a very sweet apple? How much, you know, what's the texture like? Because texture is a part of flavor as well. How much of that really fruity, apple-y flavor do you get in there? And if you want to go a little further, you can start to ask, you know, are there little notes of, you know, some apples have a slightly pear-ish flavor, things like that. So it's just a matter of thinking about it. And actually, if you've got several apples lined up in front of you of different varieties, you can contrast them.
You know, it's interesting.
Which apples are the sweetest? Which ones have the most of that apple-y flavor?
I have in front of me, in my hand, in fact, a Honeycrisp apple. And I asked Brianne Chasso, one of my producers, to go get one of these for me today because I didn't bring one in. And I wanted to do this experiment. I'm not going to be able to talk much as I'm eating an apple, but as I do the experiment, I'm going to ask you a question before I take a bite of my apple. I love Honeycrisp apples. At least I like how they are hard and crunchy, and that they really are sweeter than your average apple. But there is I get a hint of a tartness in there too. It's not overly sweet for me. My husband, on the other hand, it is overly sweet for him. He doesn't like the Honeycrisp apple. He wants the Macintosh. And the Macintosh to me is tart, and I don't mind tart, but it's also kind of mushy. It's not as crisp. So it's the texture of the Macintosh that I don't really appreciate. Can you talk a little bit on how our tastes are different when it comes to the flavor of foods?
Yeah,
and I'm gonna try my apple too.
Yeah, sure. Enjoy your apple. But I think there's a lot we don't know about individual differences, but we know enough by now to know that every one of us lives in their own flavor world. We said already that most of the detail of flavor comes from the sense of smell, and we actually each have about 400 different odor receptors in our nose, and you and I differ in about 30% of those. So that's over 100 receptors are different in you and than they are in me. And that means that we perceive different things. So almost certainly some of our flavor differences are due to differences in perception. And we have different versions of the sweet receptor gene, different versions of bitter receptor genes, which make us differently susceptible to bitters and sweet tastes. So, you know, I, for example, have a version of the sweet receptor that makes me, it's a little bit less sensitive, which means that I find extremely sweet things more palatable in general. Although, again, and this is experience figures in here too, that I've learned not to particularly like sweet things. Probably because I've gotten interested in other flavors, particularly ones that involve bitter. I have very sensitive bitter receptors, at least some of them, which ought to make me not like bitters, ought to make me find things too bitter. And in general, that seems not to be true, that I've learned to like the bitter of black coffee, the hops in beer, the bitter of bitter greens.
Good example. I was just going to bring up a coffee as one example. When I think many of us have our first sip of coffee, it's like, ugh. And then we, now I love coffee. Also, when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about, I want to talk a little bit about cilantro, because some people can eat cilantro and they love it, and other people think it tastes like soap. So what's going on there? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show if you have a question or an observation about flavor. We are talking with Bob Holmes, who is the author of Flavor, the Science of Our Most Neglected Sense. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
This is delicious.
Will you stop that, please?
So, what is your favorite flavor? What makes you go, and what doesn't? And can you describe why? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We are talking about the science of flavor with our guest, Bob Holmes, who is the author of Flavor, the Science of Our Most Neglected Sense. Bob, I wanted to ask you a little bit, if you could explain that. I love coffee, love coffee. Maybe I love caffeine because I have some right now and I have it all morning long. But I do remember the very first time, I think I was a young teen and my parents drank coffee and I had my first slug of coffee and I absolutely hated it. And I thought, how can people drink this stuff? And now I can't live without it. Does something happen as we age that allows us to tolerate that bitter more?
More what happens is that we've learned that flavor comes with a pleasing jolt of caffeine.
That's
that it does help. We enjoy the buzz, and therefore we learn to like the flavor.
Isn't that funny? The same goes
because
for
of
beer?
The consequences. Yep, sure. That you begin to associate that bitterness of the hops with a pleasant evening with friends.
You know, but given the choice, if I can have a nice, smooth oatmeal stout as opposed to a really hoppy beer, I'll take the one that's not really hoppy. So what does that say?
Yeah, it might say something about your flavor perception. Mm-hmm. It might say something about what you've learned to like.
Oh, I was just going to take a caller.
It's hard to tell.
Yeah. I was just going to go to a caller who had something to say about the hoppiness of beer, and then they dropped off. Apparently, he was going to say a similar thing. He said he used to hate the IPA beers for the longest time, which are the high in hops beers, and now he loves them. And he wanted to know what's up with that. And so I guess you're saying the same thing, is that you were associating that with a nice, mild buzz, and you learned to tolerate that that bitterness.
Or else you begin to learn to appreciate the complexities of the flavor.
Yeah. Let's go next to Benjamin in Appleton. Hi, Benjamin.
Hello.
Hi.
So I wanted to mention something that I've heard before, that people generally can be grouped into categories by how they're how sensitive they are to flavors, into normal tasters, and then there's apparently super tasters and non-tasters. And I kind of prescribe to this because I consider myself a non-taster. I really like things that are very bitter, bitter greens, IPAs. I even really love the infamous durian fruit. But I was wondering, because you seem to be under the conception that flavors are more of learned, whether you like them. But I kind of think that, in general, there are certain things that certain people will never like. What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, there certainly is this concept of the super taster versus the ordinary taster versus the non-taster, which has to do with, you know, how many taste buds basically are on your tongue. People with more tend to get more intense flavor experiences, and those are the people we call super tasters, which sounds like a wonderful thing, but as you pointed out, often super tasters don't eat a lot of different things because it's just too intense. So many super tasters have really bland diets. But once again, as so many things, that's not all there is to it. Because, you know, as it turns out, when I had my tongue inspected, I'm probably a super taster. And yet I don't have a narrow diet. I like the intense things. One researcher I talked to suggested that that besides the, you know, non-taster to super-taster differences, there's also a difference between people who are food adventurous and people who are not food adventurous. And it's the not adventurous super-tasters that have the really narrow diets. And those of us that are more adventurous like the intense experiences and seek them out even though they're intense. So the fact that you like all the, you know, the bitter greens and the bitter IPAs might not mean that you're a non-taster. It might just mean that you're food adventurous.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting because I love the bitter greens, but I can pass on the bitter beer. So I suppose it. I like my greens more than my beer. Oh yeah.
Well, they're different bitter receptors as well. That we have. There's about 20 different bitter receptors and that are focused on different bitter chemicals. Because bitter is basically to detect toxins in our food. Toxins like caffeine and the stuff that makes hops bitter are probably in high quantities. They're toxins. And so...
That is fascinating. So I missed that part. So we have the bitter receptor to tell us, don't eat this thing, it could hurt you.
Yeah.
And then we eat it anyway.
That's right, yep, because we've learned. But that's why, that first taste of coffee is instantly rejected. That's why, you know, when you watch a baby eating something bitter, or even an adult who gets surprised, you make that yucky face, you know, you scrunch up your face and you stick your tongue out, which is basically it's pushing the food back out of your mouth.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And you have a lemon on the cover of the book, and that is something, seeing a little kid getting a first taste of lemon. It's bitter, but that's sour. Is it different? Is bitter and sour different?
Sour is probably an aversive taste too. It marks something, either an unripe fruit that isn't ready to eat yet, or sometimes it marks spoilage.
Yeah.
So probably initially sour is there as a don't eat this signal.
Oh, Jeremy emails, the Zestar apple is my favorite. It's crunchy with zippy acid and a mild sweetness. I'm with Jeremy. I like the Zestar apple, too, which is similar and a little earlier in the season than the Honeycrisp. So is that a good way to describe his favorite flavor or his favorite apple? It's crunchy with zippy acid and a mild sweetness.
That sounds like a nice articulate description to me. Yeah. I don't know the Zestar apple. I'm jealous of you there in Wisconsin for all the apples that you get.
We have awesome apples.
Yes, you do.
Let's see. We have Cameron who emails. I recently picked up a carrot turmeric juice, and I thought I wouldn't like it after the first few sips. It's very bright at first, then it gets a little sweet, and then it becomes spicy. It's reminiscent of a Bloody Mary. Interesting. You have any comment on that?
It sounds interesting. Is about all I can say, I think. But again, here's someone who's paying attention, which is great.
Yeah. Let's go next to Lynn in Bayview. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
I called because 15 years ago on a trip to Norway with my mother, which is the homeland of my grandmother, who immigrated, I noticed that when they served breakfast, everything was delicious, and every restaurant we went to, everything was wonderful, and there wasn't a meal that I didn't totally, totally enjoy. In the United States, it's not so much the case. It's very hard for me to find restaurants that are my go-to restaurants that I always go to that I just love. And I was wondering if taste isn't somehow genetically programmed or hereditary in a way.
Ah. What do you think, Bob?
That's an interesting thought. I'm not aware of any research on that to suggest that that people from Northern Europe are tuned to the flavors of Northern Europe or anything like that. But I don't know. I mean, I think in general, the genetic differences between people of different ethnic origins are smaller than most of us would expect. So I think a little surprised if there were substantial genetic differences. What there are, of course, are cultural differences. If growing up you were exposed to a lot of Norwegian foods, then they'll seem familiar. They'll seem reminiscent of your childhood and trigger all sorts of these emotional bells.
Right,
Lynn, you have to tell me if lutefisk is a part of your fond memories.
Well, actually, I'm one of the few people who do tolerate it well. I do like it, and I enjoyed aquavit. I never had that in the United States, and I thought that was a really different, good sensation. And just all the, I think the cultural point might be nailing it, because I grew up with fish for breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And so that the cultural aspect, I hadn't thought of that. I just thought maybe my taste buds had somehow been passed down from ancestors from long ago.
Yeah, very interesting, Lynn. Yeah. But as far as you know, Bob, there's no, I mean, we're not inheriting our parents' taste buds necessarily.
Oh, well we are inheriting our parents' taste buds, but it's not clear that Norwegian taste buds, people of Norwegian ancestry have different flavor genes than people of German ancestry or French ancestry.
Yeah. Have you ever had lutefisk, Bob?
I have. it always struck me as the sort of thing that, if you lived on a diet of salt cod all winter long, and then you had lutefisk once at Christmas time, that would be great, and then you're glad to go back to the salt cod for the rest of the winter.
For those who don't know, and most people listening probably do, but it's cod that's soaked in like a lye-like substance to apparently dry it out or something, and then it's rehydrated. People described it on the program as being very gelatinous and not it. But they also said it was a vehicle for butter. If you had plenty of butter and mashed potatoes and you mixed it all up, then it was tolerable. Is that how you found it?
That's my recollection, too. And I think the people who introduced me to it said white wine also helps.
Oh, there we go. There we go. You know, it's funny, too, though, is that everybody said it's not just eating that lutefisk, which I have been putting off and always finding excuses not to try it, though I do promise sometime to do it. It is the family atmosphere or going to the church dinner that serves it.
Mm-hmm.
It's everything associated with that good time at the church and dining with others that makes this, I guess, a cultural experience that maybe that masks the bad taste.
Yeah, that could well be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Bob Holmes is our guest. He is a longtime correspondent for New Scientist magazine, and he is the author of Flavor, the Science of Our Most Neglected Sense. And we welcome your questions about our sense of taste or how we perceive flavor. Do you have favorite flavors? Do you have questions about how why some people love certain flavors and other people hate them? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We all love food that tastes good, but if you were forced to describe flavor, why we like or dislike certain foods, could you do it? Our guest this hour says that for many of us, flavor remains a vague, underdeveloped concept. And by learning more about the science behind it, we can have a better appreciation for the vast and varied flavors that we encounter every day. And we welcome your questions and your observations and your favorite and least favorite flavors for Bob Holmes, who is the author of Flavor, the Science of Our Most Neglected Sense. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Bob, I promised listeners that I was going to ask about why I like cilantro. I put it on a lot of stuff. But my niece says it tastes like soap. Why do two people, even in the same family, perceive the taste of something so different?
Part of it has to do with a particular odor receptor. They've actually found that there is an odor receptor that makes a difference to whether people like cilantro. It's, if you want to be technical, it's OR6A2. You know, one of those 400-some odor receptors. People with one variant of that gene like cilantro, and people with the other variant don't, or at least tend not to. It turns out there must be a lot of other things going on, too. Again, probably learning. Maybe other odor receptors make a difference as well. But, you know, I think the studies suggest that about 10% of the difference between, you know, people's preference is because of this one gene.
Interesting. I don't know if you're going to have an answer for this or not, but why does everybody in the world like goat cheese except me? It tastes goaty.
I would guess again that it's to do with odor receptors that pick up those. What are they? I think they're, you know, the fatty acids or something like that in the goat cheese.
Yeah, people say, "Oh, so, that tastes tangy," and I'm like, "It tastes like a barnyard," and that makes sense. I'm smelling it.
Well, see, this is one of the things that we don't understand well. We don't know, for most odors, we don't know what the receptor is that detects it. So no one knows, I don't think, which odor receptors are responsible for perceiving goat cheese. And so they can't, you know, the molecules in goat cheese. And so they can't compare you and me and find out why, or better would be you and my wife and find out why she really loves goat cheese and you really dislike it and I'm somewhere in the middle.
there we go.
We just don't know.
I also brought in this morning some watermelon. It just was something that, because this is, we were talking about this in our meeting yesterday as we're preparing for the show. I love watermelon. I can eat it all day. And I don't need anything to accompany it. But I know people that put salt on their watermelon, and I just sprinkled some salt on my watermelon, and I asked, my mom was one of them. She used to put salt on her watermelon. And some people say, yeah, that's the only way to eat it. They say it brings out the flavor more. Do you have any scientific explanation as to why people would put salt on their watermelon?
I asked a variant of that question to some of the flavor scientists that I talked to for the book, and it seems to have, part of it probably has something to do with the fact that salt helps to draw water and, you know, therefore dissolved molecules out of the cells in the watermelon, and therefore it makes them more accessible, I think.
Yeah, and I just
is roughly the explanation.
I just ate a piece of watermelon with salt on it, and it's so much better without it. I don't know why. Anyway, I love salt. I do like. I put salt on everything. Is there something about salt that is it? Am I just tasting the salt that's why I pour that on savory dishes anyway?
Well, no. It does help liberate flavors in the way that I described. So it does make a difference.
Let's go back to the phones. Mike in Polk County is with us. Hi, Mike.
Hi. You know, I guess I'm a defender of lutefisk, but I would expand my defense to other things. And I think lutefisk is a good example of how you have to really take into account other things other than just the straight flavor. In other words,
Oh, Mike, I'm sorry, your phone is breaking up, but I know exactly what he's going to say, that lutefisk really is just has a very neutral taste, or maybe bland taste, but it's the mouth feel of that jello fish that makes us not liking it, and let some of us to not, actually, I'm just afraid to eat it. And he says, don't confuse taste with these other attributes. What about that?
Well, mouthfeel is a part of taste. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that what puts people off about the mouthfeel of lutefisk is that it's not what you expect fish to be like. Because it is rather jello-like, as I recall. It's been decades since I've had it. But, we don't expect fish to be jello-like. No one objects when jello is jello-like. So it's not the texture itself that's the problem. It's the texture in the context of fish.
I get it. And that's, in a way, you know, our caller was saying, hey, it doesn't taste bad, but it feels bad in your mouth. And you're saying that's part of the whole, all of that contributes to the flavor of something.
Yeah, that the brain is putting all of these things together. It's taking taste, and it's taking smell and mouthfeel, and you know what a thing looks like, and even the sound, like the crunchiness of potato chips, and expectations, and all of that stuff gets smushed together in the brain to make flavor. And if the parts don't go together in the way we expect, then the brain can sometimes reject that. One of the researchers I talked to said, well, his favorite example of that is that, you know, in Europe, in a lot of Europe, milk is sold in cardboard cartons that you can't really reseal tightly. And so if he has a half-empty carton of milk and it goes in the fridge next to a sliced onion or a cut-up half an onion, then the milk takes on the onion flavors. And even though he knows the milk is good, because he just opened it yesterday, he can't drink it because the oniony flavor does not go with milk. And as a result, the brain rejects it. And probably something similar is happening with that jello-like texture of lutefisk.
Yeah.
this isn't what fish is supposed to be like. Something's wrong here.
Yeah, onion milk would not be not be my favorite either.
Yeah.
We are talking with Bob Holmes. He is the author of Flavor, The Science of Our Most Neglected Sense. And our next caller is Holly in River Falls. Hi, Holly.
Hi. Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks. You have an interesting question. Did this happen to you?
Yes, it has. I was wondering why our tastes and our favor for tastes change so much during pregnancy and why they might be different, completely different after the pregnancy is over than they were before the pregnancy.
For example, Holly, for you?
I noticed that before I had been pregnant, I preferred white wine. And while I was pregnant with my oldest son, I had real strong cravings for red wine. And then ever since, I've preferred red wine.
So explain that, Bob.
I'm not sure I can. As for why things change during pregnancy, that's probably pretty clear, is that people tend to be pickier about what they eat. There's a stronger tendency to avoid foods with toxins, you know, bitter foods and things like that, just because you've got this developing embryo inside that's sensitive. So that's probably why people, that's one of the explanations for morning sickness and for why people tend to be pickier eaters while they're pregnant. But why it's a lasting effect, I don't know. And we've certainly seen that in our house, too. My wife and I drank coffee every morning until she was pregnant. And after her pregnancy, she didn't want to drink coffee in the morning all the time. So now we have tea. And we have for 20 years.
That's really something. I was going to say that my mom mentioned that to me, that during her pregnancy she gave up coffee, even though she was a coffee addict, and she went back to it. but she didn't during pregnancy, and that would make sense. Your theory that she's tasting that bitter and that maybe something primal went off and said toxic, don't have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's probably right.
Yeah, interesting. And I've actually heard from women who could not tolerate milk until after their pregnancy. They were lactose intolerant, and then I don't know, something changed in their body, and they were able to tolerate milk after that. So it's a little different than taste, but that pregnancy does things to people, I guess.
Sally, it sure seems to.
Sally in Waukesha. Hi, Sally.
Hi. Yeah, my question is specifically about onions, but more generally about the aging of our taste buds, because I basically can't eat onions or anything with onions in it, and I can tell if there's an onion in it, even though everyone around me can't taste the onions, I can. So I noticed with my nephews, as well as my own children, when they were young, they didn't like onions, but as they grew, by the time they were in their teens or 20s, they all ate onions, every single one of them. But yet, I still can't eat onions. So I'm just wondering, is there something about our taste buds aging that allows us to eat things that we couldn't when we were young? And is there any hope that someday I'll be able to eat an onion?
Hey, Sally, I'm curious. Let me ask a question. Do you tolerate garlic, or, you know, let's say you accidentally eat onions? Does it make you sick, or is it just...
No, right. No, there's no allergy. I can... If you cut them small enough and fry them well enough and put them in a spaghetti sauce, I can eat onions. So they just have to be almost negligible. But no, and I use onion powder a lot. So it isn't actually just the flavor. I don't know. I can't even explain it. But no, it doesn't make me sick, and I love garlic.
Very interesting question. I only ask because my husband doesn't have an allergy, but he does get ill if he eats onion or garlic. That plant, he doesn't tolerate it very well. But anyway, what about that? So she cannot eat onions if they look like onions.
Yeah, that's a good question, and I don't know for sure. Part of the question was about why people eat things as adults that they don't as kids.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's largely, I think, a question of experience, of learning to eat things. That you know, we're omnivores, and there's a pretty pretty strong evolutionary pressure, I think, to for little kids to not just eat anything they see. And so kids tend to be picky eaters, especially right around the age when they're first able to run around on their own unsupervised, which makes sense, that you don't want to be just eating every plant you see. But gradually over time, you know, what the experts say is it takes a dozen exposures for a kid to like some new food. So if you feed your kid asparagus and he doesn't like it, don't worry, just feed it to him again. And, you know, the rule at our house was you have to have one taste, and then you can refuse to eat it. But eventually those tastes, and the fact that the parents are eating them and eating the food and enjoying it, add up, and the kids will eventually accept things into their diet. And sometimes it takes years.
Thanks, Sally. Adrian in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, good morning, Joy. Good morning, Bob.
Morning.
Women crave chocolate, and women need magnesium. And there's a lot of magnesium in chocolate. And if a woman takes a magnesium supplement, not only does her craving for chocolate go away, but when she tastes chocolate again, it's not any good anymore.
I'm not having any magnesium. No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding, but I'm going to try that actually, just to see what happens. That's interesting. And it's a little different than taste, but maybe, I don't know if you have a comment on magnesium and chocolate, Bob, but I also just thought about it, that so many people do crave chocolate. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I can't speak to the magnesium part because that's not something I ran across, but it sounds plausible at least. Cravings, there's been a little bit of study on cravings, and it's not, I don't think they're fully understood at this point either. Some of cravings is about getting specific nutrients. That, you know, after we've sweat a lot, we crave salt because it replaces the electrolytes that we've lost in the sweat. So part of that is, you know, that's part of what's going on, but there are also, I mean, cravings for emotional reasons, and I suspect for a lot of people that's what chocolate is filling, is the emotional craving.
Just Kara on Facebook writes, white chocolate is an abomination. It's sickly sweet and no flavor, and it's not really chocolate either. But anyway, I just wanted to share that. We have just a minute to go.
I'm in her camp, yeah.
Yeah, right. We just have a minute to go. Is there, leave us with a final tip or two on how we can maybe sharpen our sense of flavor in our day-to-day life.
Oh, I think probably the bottom line is just pay attention. If you think about what you're eating as so many of your listeners seem to be doing, that's the big part.
And any thoughts on the future of flavor science? Do you see us filling in the gaps anytime soon?
We will, yeah. It's actually a great time to be a flavor scientist. There's lots of neat new stuff coming. So, yeah, keep watching the news. There should be exciting things coming.
Thank you very much for being with us. Bob Holmes is the author of Flavor, the Science of Our Most Neglected Sense. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Chris Molina for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Good enough reason to live. Good enough reason to live. Sitting in the bathtub, high five playing low, digging old Al Green, well, you must know.